What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
For decades, he's been the king of Memphis.
It's good to be king of your own little town.
You want to see the king? You think anybody would pay to come down and see a sawed-off runt? Bug-eyed Bill Dundee? No, they come to see me, baby.
King of them all, right here it is, baby. The greatest wrestler that ever lived and ever will step into a ring. You're looking at him, and I am the champion.
And you may be familiar with his work in WWE, too.
I'll show you who the real king of the World Wrestling Federation is. It's the most electrifying move. It's Sports Entertainment Today. Oh, the people devil!
For 50 years, he's been known all over the world as one of wrestling's biggest stars. And now, he's decided to share all of his favorite stories from his 50 years in wrestling with you.
Tell me a story.
Why don't you put your false teeth in backward and eat yourself to death?
Oh, that's one of my favorites.
This is the Jerry Lawler Show.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Jerry Lawler Show. I am so excited. We have a super special show this week that you are going to love. As always, you can follow the King on Twitter at Jerry Lawler. You can follow the show at Lawler Show. Same for Instagram. But we want to hop into it this week with our special guest, King. Can you provide us with the introduction?
Well, I'll do my best. Like you said, Sean, I am so excited about this podcast today. The biggest thing, without a doubt, the biggest thing that ever happened to me, not maybe just in my wrestling career, but in my entire life, was my, gosh, I don't even know what you, adventures. I'm going to call them adventures. My adventures in life with Andy Kaufman. I mean, everybody, still, it's been like 35 years, and I can't go anywhere. Almost every single day, somebody will come up to me and mention the match or the Letterman show with Andy Kaufman. It made such an indelible mark on my career and on professional wrestling in general. I mean, and wrestling going to Hollywood and becoming sports entertainment. Andy Kaufman was a huge, huge part of that. And so today, as our special guest, I don't even know how this happened. I really don't. I'm so fortunate. I haven't spoken to this young man, I don't think, in almost 20 years since the time we did the movie Man on the Moon about Andy's life. But we have, as our special guest on the line right now with us, the brother of Andy Kaufman, Michael Kaufman. Michael, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm great, Jerry. Thank you. And I love hearing you speak. You know, it was big for you. It was just as big for Andy. And it was Andy loved his adventures with you so much, he never cashed any checks. There were five checks that my father found when he died. He never cashed them because it would have taken away the purity and the pure joy of it, of all that he did with you. So it was huge for him too.
Well,
let's
see if we can. I've told people this over the years, and I don't know. Because I didn't, I mean, I got a chance to be what I thought was fairly close to Andy and become good friends with Andy over the weeks and months and almost a year that we got to work together and everything. But he did sort of tell me a little bit about his childhood and his background. And apparently, you know, I guess you guys were wrestling fans growing up, and that actually had an influence on Andy's whole life, didn't it? Wrestling did, didn't it?
Yes, it did. I happen to have in front of me, Andy's idol was Nature Boy Buddy Rogers.
Yep.
Champion, world heavyweight champion from 1961 to 1963, I believe. In 1981, this is like 3 years before Andy died, Andy wrote a short story called Golden Boy. And it's the story about Buddy. It's a story about his story about Buddy Rogers and how Andy became interested in wrestling. Would you like me to read a little bit of it to you?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. I've never heard about this. I knew he was a huge fan, but I didn't know he wrote the story.
As a matter of fact, Buddy Rogers was Andy's manager on Saturday Night Live when there was a wrestle-off. The whole country had a tournament where the winner of this wrestling tournament would wrestle Andy on Saturday Night Live, and Buddy Rogers was Andy's manager that night on TV. You can see it, you know, on SNL repeats. Anyway, so so remember, these are Andy's words. This is Andy. He wrote it on January 15th, 1981 at 2:08 a.m. in the morning on Green Valley Road. That's where he was living. Andy would date everything he did, every time he wrote. So here we go, Golden Boy. I remember the first time I ever saw the Golden Boy. It was on a local television show in which he was wrestling for the undisputed championship of the world. I had been turning the channels looking for something suitable for my little brother and myself to watch while my parents were away for the evening. It was past our bedtime, but the babysitter was on the phone with someone, I think her boyfriend, so we stayed up and watched TV. As we turned the dial, we stopped at each show that was on, watched it for a few seconds, and then changed to another one. When we came upon the wrestling show, we sat there. And by the way, this is about 1955, 56 at latest.
Yeah.
Wrestling had not been on TV for long at this point. Anyway, so we found it. All right. When we came upon the wrestling show, we sat there mesmerized and watched the whole thing as Golden Boy kicked and choked and cheated his way into the championship behind the referee's back. After he won, he strutted around the ring with his newly won crown and flexed his muscles as the crowd booed. That night, my brother and I became addicted. Now, that's just the beginning. If you want me to go on or spread it out or, you know,
okay,
just let me know.
Could you read another couple paragraphs? I'm mesmerized by this.
Oh, the whole thing is tremendous. And to get, 36 years after Andy died to hear his words for the first time, must be great. It's great for me to read it. All right. For the next 2 years, Golden Boy remained champ. He would use every trick in the book to win his matches. And when he couldn't win, he would purposely get disqualified so that he didn't lose a championship because the rules stated that a title could not change hands on a disqualification. The public hated him and hoped for the day when he would lose. However, my brother and I got caught up in the man's charisma and became avid fans of his. Sometimes he had a manager who interfered in the matches, stabbing the opponents with his cane if they were besting this champion. We loved watching this manager brag obnoxiously during interviews as Golden Boy nodded his head in agreement, flexed his muscles, and said intermittently, "That's right, Daddy." One time he was supposed to jump from the top rope onto the stomach of Rick Davis. Is that real? Because I remember there was Pepper Gomez. I don't know if anyone knows Rick Davis. But anyway, he's supposed to jump on the stomach of Rick Davis, the man who claimed to have a cast iron stomach. Davis claimed that nothing, including Golden Boy's famous knee drop from the top rope, could penetrate or hurt his cast iron stomach. Golden Boy claimed he would be able to hurt Davis. And as he climbed to the top rope, and the moment Golden Boy jumped down, landing his knee directly on the windpipe of Davis's neck.
Wow, yeah.
Davis started flailing his legs in pain while Golden Boy strutted around the ring as the announcer expressed disgust at the display of the betrayal. Then Golden Boy and his manager both attacked the fallen man, and he had to be carried out on the stretcher, which Golden Boy repeatedly kicked over as the medics tried to carry him out. When Davis recovered a few weeks later, he swore he would get even in a grudge match held at Madison Square Garden untelevised. We wished we could go, but had to resign ourselves to just hearing the results of the TV match because of our young age. And that's the first half. Do you want me to continue? Do you want me to come back later, or just if you had enough?
Yeah, maybe no. No, I would never get enough of this. It is amazing. You know, I think you obviously have studied a little bit about it too. That probably was Pepper Gomez. I remember reading about.
I'm sorry, Pepper Gomez. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I remember reading about that in the magazines where Nature Boy Buddy Rogers jumped on the throat of the man with the cast iron stomach. But that's amazing that Andy wrote that in 1981, and it happened back in, like you say, gosh, in the 50s or 60s or something, when in his childhood.
Yes.
Well, after you guys started, did you start watching wrestling sort of on a regular basis after that? Were your parents cool with that, or how did that go? Do you remember that as a kid?
I'm going to have to try my best to remember it. I know it was more Andy than me. And as a matter of fact, you know, don't tell Andy this, but I kind of like the good guy. Yeah, Andy thinks I was in cahoots with him in liking the bad guy, but I liked Pepper Gomez. And by the way, Killer Kowalski also did something to Pepper Gomez where he's supposed to get him in the claw hold, but he did something to cheat. Anyway, but Andy, from then, that was the beginning. When Andy said he was addicted, that was it. That was what can I say? You know, I don't think there was anything ever bigger than wrestling for him.
Yeah, and when I hear you reading Andy's actual words, and I hear him describing how Nature Boy Buddy Rogers would, he said, you know, he would strut around the ring, you know, relishing his victory and everything. It just reminds me so much of Tony Clifton. You know, that in reality, that was Andy creating a bad guy wrestler, recreating that, wasn't it?
Yes. Oh, that you could see Tony Clifton. You could also when you see Andy strut around after beating a woman, I believe that was from Buddy Rogers.
Yeah, without a doubt. I know that. I mean, once Andy started the wrestling, that was, I mean, he was always imitating Buddy Rogers. But I think that the wrestling influence was there before he even started doing the wrestling the women. I think that it just in Andy's act and creating the Tony Clifton character was him wanting to be a heel, wanting to be the bad guy in show business.
Yeah. And by the way, the Tony Clifton character started very early. You know, right. May not have gotten the press until maybe Carnegie Hall or something, but he was doing that, you know, in the mid-70s.
Yeah, I just always felt, and I feel like Andy had told me at one time that you know, when he was performing, he didn't like being called a comedian, said he never told a joke in his life, but and he enjoyed making the audience almost uncomfortable, like a bad guy wrestler, like a heel wrestler would do, rather than making them laugh or enjoy themselves. I just think that was something that was ingrained in Andy over the years, and that's why part of the thing I don't think he really liked being the latke. I don't think it was enjoyed being part of sitcoms and all of that. Did he ever express that to you?
Yes. As a matter of fact, going further with what you said, as long as he got gut reactions from the audience, he didn't care if they were happy, sad, angry. As long as he didn't like the Broadway show where you have the polite people applauding in their seats. He wanted to get to your gut, and that's what wrestling did for him, and that's what he wanted to then give to audiences.
Now, tell me a little bit about your background. You guys grew up in Long Island, New York.
Yes. We were about 35 miles from Comac Arena.
Oh, awesome! And how much older?
I was going to say New York City.
How much older?
Andy was two years older.
Oh, well, you guys were close. I had a brother that was 4 years older than me, and we were, yeah, I mean, you know, we were close, but it wasn't one of those things. I mean, he was always a little bit ahead of me in the things that he liked and disliked. But you guys, only 2 years apart, you were pretty close. When did Andy first start you know, getting him interested in, how did you know that he was wanted to be in show business?
Well, you could say the early signs were there when he started entertaining at children's birthday parties at the age of 9. He'd get paid $5 for 2 hours. And so there's something right there. Then he started advertising in the local Penny Saver. And, you know, the amount kept going up and the duration kept going down, where he was finally getting, you know, $25 for 45 minutes. And,
what kind of show would he put on? Did you see these shows?
You know, I don't think I ever went to a birthday party, but I could tell you that, Grandpa Paul, that's maternal grandfather, had a 16mm projector, which, you know, in the mid-50s, that was unheard of.
Oh, yeah.
It had sound. So Andy would play movies. He also had taken guitar lessons enough that he could play musical chairs. Let's see. Movies, musical chairs, that's probably a big chunk of it right there. And,
yeah.
And other games. He didn't know magic. So I'm not sure what other kind of games there were, but I know those two things. He had a limited movie, you know, inventory of movies that Grandpa Paul gave him. So that was the first time.
Well, how did it come about that? I mean, what was your reaction and how did he break the news to you guys that, hey, I'm going to go to Hollywood and try to be famous?
Well, it started in New York. It actually started after taking a year off after graduating high school. He went to Graham Junior College in Boston, and at Graham Junior College had his own TV show, the Uncle Andy Funhouse. And we actually have two of the shows that we were able to restore that can be seen on video. It's private. It hasn't been released or anything, but it exists, which is great to see young Andy perform. You know, we're talking about 20-year-old Andy. Anyway, so Graham is where it started. And after Graham, he comes back to New York. And the big thing was performing at the Improv in New York City and Catch a Rising Star. And at some point, Bud Friedman gets divorced and moves out to Los Angeles and opens up the Improv in Los Angeles. And he paid for Andy to come out in 1977, I believe it was, just to help him open. He loved Andy. The rumor is that Andy was the only one who Bud ever loved. You know, he's always ornery to everybody, but he loved Andy. And you could see it in the way he talks about Andy. Anyway, so Andy helped open up the Improv. You know, he'd already been great in New York to get this offer from Bud. He was on SNL already, you know, several times. And now Bud takes him out to California. And in California, he meets basically George Shapiro, who became his manager.
Right. And
George gets him involved with Taxi and, you know, Carnegie Hall happens and all that.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
This is the Jerry Lawler Show.
Let's fast forward on to once Andy started wrestling. He wrestled women. He was on, Merv Griffin's show, Wrestling Women. He was on Saturday Night Live, Wrestling Women and everything. And then, of course, that led into the fact that, were you familiar with how Andy approached or went to see Vince McMahon at a show and tried to convince Mr. McMahon Sr., Vince Sr., that he wanted to be or wanted to wrestle at an actual wrestling event?
No, I've only heard about it. I think you probably know more about it. And I think Bill Apter is the other one who would probably know more about it.
Yeah.
So I'm probably not the one to comment on it.
Okay. But then that led to the fact that, I guess he sort of got turned down by Vince Sr. because and understandably at that time, it was unheard of, so to speak, to have somebody from the outside, somebody from Hollywood or show business, get involved with wrestling, because our fans were so skeptical at the time. And that's exactly what Vince Sr. told Andy. He said, I'm just hesitant to involve a Hollywood actor with our wrestling now because of the fact that, he just didn't want the people to think that the wrestlers were actors as well. So it was understandable, but thank goodness Bill Apter was there and on hand at this meeting. And Bill was, I guess, had known Andy or was a friend of Andy's. And he told Andy about our wrestling show or in our company down in Tennessee. And Andy called us and got in touch with us. And at the time, all he wanted to do was come down and wrestle some women out of the audience, as he had been doing, in front of wrestling fans. And that's all we thought it was going to involve. And that's what happened at first. And it worked out fantastic. And Lance Russell, he did some interviews with Andy and Andy played the bad guy. I think he did exactly what Nature Boy Buddy Rogers had done in the past. And the people in Memphis just despised him. They hated him. So it worked out fine. And he came back several times. And then finally that led to where I went to Andy and I said, Andy, you've gone just about as far as you can go with wrestling women. I said, what you need to do is you need to have a match with a man. You and I need to have a match. And of course, I was kind of the top guy in Memphis at the time. In actuality, Michael, I just wanted to get the rub off this big Hollywood TV star, right? So that's how our match came about. And did you hear that we were going to have the match before it actually happened, or did you not hear anything about it until actually we had the match?
I'll answer that second. I just want to say, as much as you wanted to get the Hollywood rub to Andy, it was like, wow, Jerry the King Lawler.
Oh, God.
Yeah, he was getting it from you. Whatever you're feeling, he was feeling the same thing.
You know what, Michael? That may be so, but neither one of us ever told each other that.
Oh, that's funny. You know, I imagine that happens today with entertainers and athletes. They're probably each in awe of each other.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Yeah.
At least I know it certainly happens in my case all the time. I mean, I'll meet somebody that I'm a huge fan of and don't really want to admit it to their face or whatever. But then I'm always shocked and in awe of the fact that they even know who I am or something like that. So that's probably the way that went down with Andy and I. But, yeah, I just couldn't believe that I was getting to do something with this guy that's on the top rated television show in all of the nation on Taxi every week.
So now to answer your question, the first time Andy ever went to Memphis, do you remember who picked him up at the airport?
No, I don't.
It was you. I was with Andy. Andy and I flew down from Chicago. I don't know. We were visiting our sister for some reason. And we flew down. It was the time that he wrestled the five women, including I forget her name. Her name's escaping me. You know the one who he had the
Foxy.
Foxy, yes. So it was five or six women that night. I was with Andy. You picked us up at the airport, and so I was there for the beginning of it.
Wow.
Now Did I know in advance what was going to happen? Because that was the only time I went down. I have a feeling that I was just good with, I was just intuitive with whatever was going on. So Andy didn't have to tell me anything. I just would shake my head. Yes, of course, this is what's next. You know, it's like, yeah, this would be likely for it to happen next. I'm not surprised. But Andy didn't, you know, Andy was a meditator, transcendental meditation.
Oh, no.
They tell you he did it twice a day for, you know, for 15 years, you know, until he died. Well, a couple of months before he died, he couldn't do it anymore. But anyway, they tell you not to tell anyone else your mantra. If you do, it'll weaken the effect. Well, I believe Andy carried that out in life, that if he was to tell me what he was going to do with you, it would weaken the whole thing. It was better just to keep it in. And just let it happen, let it develop, and probably let it be more spontaneous, appear more spontaneous.
Well, that was the great thing about being around Andy, and of course then basically working with Andy, even in the ring, even finally as far as all this went. You talked about meditating. I can't tell you about the fact that a couple of different times. You know, it came time for his match, and they're like ringing the bell, and Andy was off in another room, and he was meditating. And I'm pulling my hair out, going, "Oh my gosh, somebody knock on the door, get him out there! You know, it's time for his match." But I mean, you're right. He that was a ritual of his, and he didn't ever deviate from that. But the great thing about Andy and I, and probably one of the reasons he didn't tell you about what was going to happen was and a lot of people probably won't believe this, but either of us, we really didn't know what was going to happen. So much of because Andy was so great at it, so much of the stuff that he did and that we did was improvisational. I mean, honest to God, I'll tell you this. I never knew that Andy was going to lay there in the ring and ask for an ambulance and demand to go to the hospital and spend 3 days in the hospital with his neck in traction after our match. Never knew that was going to happen.
And
then I didn't even speak to Andy for a while after that. You know, I mean, it was like, I go home after the match. And of course, everybody's talking about it. You know, the big Hollywood stars is Jerry Lawler tries to break the guy's neck and he's in the hospital. His neck, he's in traction. It's all on the news and newspapers everywhere. And I'm beginning to believe it myself because, you know, I didn't hear from Andy and I see these interviews with him. He's just laying there with his neck stretched out in traction in a hospital. So that's so much of Andy was like that. And it was just off the cuff, spur of the moment. And it just always seemed to work with Andy. So what did you guys think? I know I met your dad once at the premiere of the, you know, of the Man on the Moon movie. And I'll never forget, he came up to me and he said, "Jerry, we just hated you for a long time because we thought you tried to break our son's neck." And it was crazy. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. He would just be speaking for he and his wife and then my mother, Janice.
Uh-huh.
She's been interviewed, I think even on Letterman once, where, you know, when Andy went, when he took his parents on David Letterman's show to tell them for the first time ever that he loved them. He had taken a workshop which taught you how to tell your people that you love them. Between you, me, and everyone listening, it wasn't the first time he had said that he loved them. He had taken the workshop recently, but the "I love you" flowed very easily throughout the family. So it was just Stanley and Janice who really could not get into the wrestling. Let me just go back for a second to childhood, watching TV, wrestling on TV.
Yeah.
One night, towards the beginning, it wasn't too far after the meeting Buddy Rogers, you know, on TV that I read that Andy wrote. Maybe a couple months later, Andy and I are on the bed imitating wrestling. We're on a twin bed where the black and white TV is right in front of us, you know, like 6 inches from the end of the bed.
Right.
And we're wrestling. And Andy says, and you might, these words might sound familiar, put me, I'll let you put me in a headlock.
So Andy had, I
put Andy in a headlock. He had me put him in a headlock, which sounds very familiar to something that happened, like 26 years later, with you.
Right.
But anyway, so I must have twisted my torso with him in the headlock. Next thing I know, Andy's in traction for 3 weeks.
He's
not in the hospital. He's at home. So now my memory, and I'm so young, but my memory is Andy in bed with his foot up in a, you know, almost like a sit, an Abbott Costello comedy, you know, where his foot was up tied to a pulley. But, and he was there for 3 weeks, and Andy thinks that what made the pile driver so legitimate was that he had scar tissue from what I did to Andy that night, and that gave it, that had the doctor say, well, yeah, we found something. So it made it all more real. When you know he did it with you,
yeah. And Andy told me later. I mean, you know, I was used to working with every night working with these big, tough, rugged, you know, professional wrestlers who did this day in and day out. And to us, when you take a back suplex, you know, you tuck your chin down your, and as long as you don't land right on your neck or the back of your head, you're fine. You take the brunt of the blow with your shoulders. And, you know, it hurts a little bit, but it's nothing bad or anything. And so I was thinking that's a very safe move. And then, of course, I'd given a pile driver to 500 different wrestlers and, you know, never broke anybody's neck or never really seriously hurt anybody with it. So I was going to protect Andy and all that stuff. And I was told him before the match, I said, you know, you won't get hurt. This will be fine. Because he was legitimately concerned. You know, at first when I approached him with the idea of having the match with me, he really wasn't sold on it. You know, he wanted to stick to wrestling women and he was afraid he'd get hurt. And of course, you know, there were concerns. He was doing taxi and insurance concerns and all this sort of stuff. But I had to assure Andy that he wouldn't get hurt. And then, of course, when I see him laying there after the match, I see him go to the hospital and lay there in traction. I'm, you know, He got it over on me as well. I'm thinking, oh my gosh. And then later on, he did actually tell me, he said, I said, that stuff didn't really hurt you, did it? And he said, yeah, it did. He said, when you dropped me back on the back of my head, he said, I know you told me to tuck my chin. He said, but I guess I didn't or whatever. He said, I was like knocked out for a minute or so. He said, I was like unconscious. And he said, and then I said, well, the pile driver didn't hurt. He said, yeah, it did. So, I mean, I don't know if he was working me or what, but that he always told me that. But I guess not bad. But anyway, then so
I had never heard that.
Yeah. That was just a conversation between he and I. But go ahead.
I was going to say what I got out of the whole thing was, you know, you even telling me that Andy was scared, was concerned. Never flowed through to me. What I got from Andy is that he totally trusted you.
Oh, he did, without a doubt. And that was so funny because that was something that he told me too. He said, "Look," he said, "I'm just so happy to be doing this because I love wrestling so much." And he said, "I don't want to. I'm not trying to tell you anything. I don't want any input." He said, "I'm just going to try to do what you want to do." He said, "Because you're the, you know, that's how much he respect he had for wrestling in general. It wasn't like he just wanted to do it. He just wanted to be involved. He wasn't trying to run the show or anything like that. He was just happy to be there. And he trusted me explicitly. And like I said, he said, I mean, it didn't hurt him enough to have to go to the hospital or anything like that. But he did say it kind of. And I guess, you know, I just, and the wrestlers take that for granted. Yeah, the stuff does hurt. Everything that you do, you can't pick somebody up over your head and slam them down onto a mat or shoot them in the air with a backdrop or jump off the top rope and land on somebody without it hurting. It does hurt, right. but people just, you know, when you're in the business, it's like being a football player or something. When you get tackled, that hurts, but that's part of the game. You take it for granted. And so that's the way that Andy realized it was. But did you guys at home, when you heard the news the next day, were you concerned? Did you think that Andy was really hurt?
No, I was not. And Andy called me from the hospital room. He was very soft-spoken, I must say. Maybe he was still kind of dazed from what happened the night before. He called me the next day, so it wasn't like I had to speak to him right away. I wanted to say, I was thinking that Andy, a guy who was totally creative and did his own thing, and didn't like being on Taxi because it wasn't his creation.
Right.
He told me that he followed everything. You know, he took your lead and followed everything. He didn't try to create anything or suggest anything. He totally trusted you in your instincts for creating drama and just doing the right thing for the entertainment purposes. He totally trusted you and didn't have to interject any of his creativity, which just normally would just come so naturally to him. So just another great compliment that he is giving you.
Well, but Andy's talent was, because of the wrestling influence, was so great. I'll never forget, he came back and I brought him over to my house. And, you know, back in the day, I had one of those little camcorders, you know, that you hold up the little VHS tape. And I sat Andy down in the front room of my house, and we made these short interviews that we could play each week because there's going to be a few weeks before Andy could come back. So we needed being on TV every Saturday. So we cut these different promos, and I'm sure you've seen some over the years about Andy doing the hygiene tips to the people of the South.
With the toilet paper and the soap.
Oh, my gosh. He was classic on that. And all I did there, I just gave him, you know, the little general idea, and then Andy just went off. And they were so effective. They were so effective that after the third one, the station manager, the manager of Channel 5 there in Memphis, called us up and said, "Please, Jerry, don't play those Andy Kaufman interviews about hygiene anymore. We're getting so many." He said, "All week long, we're getting the switchboard blowing up. People are complaining about it."
Just one more time to thank Buddy Rogers and what Andy, you know, where it all started for Andy.
Thanks for listening to part one of an outstanding conversation between the King, Sean, and the brother of the late Andy Kaufman, Michael Kaufman. Part two will be available on Thursday. In the meantime, make sure that you head over to MyBookie and use the promo code OVERTIME because you can double your first deposit and get up to $1,000 in free play. It'll add all kinds of excitement to your betting this NFL season. If you want to win big, MyBookie is the place for that. You can bet on the Kings Browns. You can bet on Sean's Jets, although I don't really recommend that. I would bet against the Jets if you want to make money. But whatever bets you want to put in, whether it's on the games, whether it's on props, whether it's on futures, it's all available right at your fingertips at MyBookie. And if you head over there now, use the promo code OVERTIME. You'll double your first deposit and you'll get up to $1,000 in free play. Thanks again for listening to the Jerry Lawler Show. Make sure that you follow the show on Twitter @LawlerShow and follow the King on Twitter @JerryLawler.